time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jess Speer. Jess Speer is the socialist alternative candidate for the Washington State Legislature, 43rd District, Position 2. Jess, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
So start out, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you are running for the state legislature.
Yeah, so I'm a member of Socialist Alternative, and I've been involved in Shama Sawant's campaigns 2012 against my current opponent, Speaker Frank Schopp. And then also in 2013, I was her volunteer coordinator, where, you know, we organized over 400 volunteers to get out there and build support to elect Shama Sawant, which, as you know, was successful. We went on to launch 15 Now, of which I was the organizing director. So for the past 6 months or so, I've been out there building support for a $15 an hour minimum wage in the community, which, of course, was also successful. So now I'm running for the Washington State House of Representatives, as you mentioned, in the 43rd District. And I'm doing that because it's obvious, just like in the Seattle City Council before Shama was elected, we don't have a voice for working people in Olympia. And you know that just by looking at what gets passed and what gets thwarted. So right now the priorities are very much skewed toward the interests of big business. Boeing gets a special session and an $8.7 billion handout while our education is criminally underfunded. We're looking at drastic cuts to transit here in King County. And, you know, we have a whole slew of social services that are not funded at the level they should be. So it's obvious that the priorities are backwards in Olympia. And we know one of the biggest reasons is because there's no unambiguous voice for working people down there. Most of the politicians, while a lot of them have good values and good intentions, I have no doubt about that, they're very much conflicted by the fact that they take corporate money. I mean, my opponent, Frank Schopp, takes money from, you know, a list of corporations that most people would be quite familiar with, including Boeing, Alaska Airlines, the Washington Restaurant Association, which I want to flag because that was one of the biggest opponents of the $15 an hour minimum wage, and that's one of his top donors. He also takes lots of money from Vulcan, you know, Paul Allen's developer company that's building all over the city and really causing the rent to skyrocket. So I think when we're looking at what's necessary, what's needed, the funding for social services, and the fact that we don't have somebody that's really arguing for that, really boldly putting forward what's necessary, and then also going out there in the community and building support for these issues, I think we really needed somebody to go down there and do that. And I was very happy to step up and run in this race. And I think that a lot of people are excited about the campaign because they've seen Shama get elected and then go on to win the highest minimum wage in the country. And of course, she didn't do that alone, and 15 Now did not do that alone. We did that with the help of labor unions that organized down in SeaTac to win the 15 down there. And then, of course, Working Washington and other community organizations in Seattle. It was a collective effort. But I don't think anybody doubts that if Shama had not been elected, that there would have been the same momentum to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage that quickly. So I think that type of fighting spirit people also want to see down in Olympia. And that's, yeah, that's why I'm running.
So specifically, what would you change or propose to change in terms of the corporate control of what happens in Olympia?
We have to end the corporate welfare that the state engages in. So there's always this talk of a revenue crisis, or we don't have enough money for this or that. And, you know, during the recession, that was mostly because we have the most regressive tax system in the entire country. And so when you have a recession and people are thrown out of their jobs and they're no longer paying that sales tax that's incredibly high in Seattle, but also statewide, then they, you know, the state doesn't have the revenue necessary to fund social services. And rather than taxing the very wealthy and the big corporations, Washington State Legislature cut social services by $10 billion. So we are talking about ending that corporate welfare. There are something like 500 corporate loopholes that exist on the books today that starve our state treasury of over $6 billion. It's not just the most recent handout to Boeing of $8.7 billion. there's a bunch of corporate loopholes that are there just, you know, to help certain sectors of the economy. And some of them just make no sense when you look at, like, golf club membership fee sales tax exemptions or cosmetic surgeries, you know, sales tax exemptions and the like. A bunch of those could be closed so that we can fund social services in a progressive manner. Right now, what we have is a very regressive tax system where the tax burden falls heavily on the shoulders of working people instead of on the very wealthy and the big corporations that are in this state. There's 68,000 millionaires that live in King County alone. Just a small tax on that wealth could provide a lot of funding for the social services instead of constantly looking at ways to increase the sales tax, increase the gas tax, add an entertainment tax, add a bag tax. You know, they're constantly looking at increasing revenue by taxing working people. We've got to shift that. And I think what's lacking is somebody that's, you know, taking no corporate money, as our campaign does. It takes no corporate money. And so is uncompromised and would go down in Olympia and very much argue for a tax on the wealthy and a tax on the big corporations. We're also talking about lifting the ban on rent control. There's a statewide ban which prevents cities like Seattle, which had the fastest rising rent in the entire country last year. And, you know, recently we've seen that's continuing that trend. They don't have the ability to enact policies to create rent stabilization, where if you're living in a home, the landlord is not allowed to raise the rent more than maybe the, you know, consumer price index, tying it to inflation a couple percentage points when your lease is up, rather than what we see now where it can go up however much the landlord wants. It can go up 100%. We see there's a building in Ravenna, the Theodora, which houses disabled and elderly people. And the person that owns the building wants to sell it to a private owner. And so essentially those residents are going to be kicked out. And they are fighting back. And we are definitely in solidarity with them. But we need to be able to have the ability in Seattle to enact policies to provide relief right now for residents. So we're calling for rent control and also for more affordable housing. There's a lot of affordable housing out there, but it's not meeting the demand. A lot of the housing that's being built right now by big developers like Paul Allen's Vulcan are these posh apartments, you know, where the rent is $1,500, $1,900 for a one-bedroom. Most working people cannot afford that much for a one-bedroom. So, but maybe they make a little too much for affordable housing, and then they're sort of stuck in the middle where they can't afford to live in the, you know, the expensive new units, but they also make a little too much for affordable housing. And so they're pushed to the outskirts of the city. And I myself have experienced that where my rent went up 15% and I had to leave. I think, you know, we need more affordable housing. We need below market rate, high quality housing. We're also calling for taxing the wealthy. That's part of ending the corporate welfare, but also taxing the very wealthy and the big corporations so that we can fully fund transit, we can fully fund education, and then also so that we can start to massively invest in clean, renewable energy. We get most of our energy from hydropower. It's 70%, and we also get a few percentage points of energy from wind. But we need to be expanding wind and solar. We know that climate change is going to cause the snowpack to decline even more, and it's going to make hydropower less reliable. So if we want to continue to be powering Seattle and the rest of the state with clean, renewable energy, we need to really invest in solar and wind. And we also need to go 100% renewable. There's no reason why we can't do that. What's lacking is somebody to really boldly advocate for it. So, you know, a massively expanding transit, which is one of the best ways Seattle itself can, you know, reduce our carbon emissions, and also investing in clean, renewable energy. Both of those things are necessary so that we can start to tackle global warming.
So transit was an issue that was tried to be brought before the legislature multiple mm-hmm. times and failed. Mm-hmm. And there are those out there that are worried about also you running being a spoiler to a mm-hmm. degree, that it saying it's so critical that the Democrats, you know, retake Olympia. What is your response to those two issues?
The first is the transportation package that they passed in the House that died in the Senate, and even the Senate version of it. again, was calling for taxing on working people. It was calling for increasing the gas tax something like 10 to 12 cents, which is ridiculous. We already pay high taxes when it comes to gas. And, you know, it's causing this problem where, you know, people driving are pitted against people that want to use transit. And we're not really providing reliable funding that's necessary so that we don't have to face the cuts that we're facing right now in King County. The proposal coming out of the city council to deal with the cuts in the city, again, from the mayor, and then a lot of the city council supports this, is, you know, a license fee, which is incredibly regressive. It doesn't matter what kind of car you drive, you're going to pay the same flat fee. I think it's $60. And then also they're talking about increasing the sales tax, which, of course, is highly regressive, and working people pay a larger share of their income towards, you know, usable goods. So to us, that's very short-sighted, and it's going to guarantee future cuts. In 2001, when we had the dot-com bubble burst, we had drastic cuts to Metro that was necessary because the funding fell. The same thing happened with the global economic recession in 2008. The funding fell, they had to cut transit, or they had to look for progressive ways of funding it. Shema Sawant and Nick Licata have put forward a progressive funding option for transit in Seattle that hopefully other localities can look at, and maybe the state legislature could take a lesson from. They're talking about enacting what's called a head tax, or an employee hours tax. And this basically, you know, puts a tax on medium and large businesses. Small businesses are exempt from this. And when you break down how much it's going to cost these businesses, it's essentially something like a penny an hour that you would add to, you know, how much you have to pay for employees. But it provides enough funding so that we can get rid of one of those regressive options. And that's what's necessary. We need people that are going to look for progressive tax options so that we can fund our social services and not put the burden on working people, but also so those social services are reliably funded. We know that the funding is going to be there. We don't have to worry about the next economic downturn really, doing away with that funding. When it comes to what's going to happen with the Speaker of the House, and if I'm elected, that'll throw it up into chaos, and whether or not people should worry about that and maybe worry that I'm going to be a spoiler, I think we have to really question the logic there, that somehow reelecting Frank Chop will send the signal that people are fed up with the regressive taxes and the failure of the Democratic Party to really lead on going towards more progressive taxation, fully funding our social services, and really ending that corporate welfare that's starving our state treasury. He has not done that in his entire 20-year career. And I think we have to question whether or not reelecting him would actually send any type of signal. In fact, I think it would send the signal that, you know, politics as usual is working, and that the rightward drift in the Democratic caucus is just fine with working people. Instead, I think we want to send the signal that, no, people are fed up. They're tired of the excuses that they're hearing, that there's a Republican, you know, obstacle that they have to overcome, or there's some right-wing Democrats that don't agree, and so we have to work to get the votes. I don't accept that logic at all. To me, that's the logic of lesser evilism, where, you know, we have to continue to vote for the lesser of the two evils because we're really worried about the Republicans coming in. If I'm elected and we take out the Speaker of the House, that will be a political earthquake. It will affect the entire state legislature and the Senate. It will make the most progressive Democrats in the caucus recognize that there's room for them to go out there and really argue for the policies that they have maybe hesitated to because the Speaker of the House stopped that. And then also, I think for more centrist Democrats, they would recognize that they're completely out of touch. It's not just in Seattle that people want to see more progressive taxation and want to see the social services funded by taxing the wealthy and taxing the big corporations. You know, people in Eastern Washington want that as well. And when it comes to something like increasing the minimum wage, there was over 60% support. So Republicans support this as well. But you don't have leadership in the House pushing these issues forward. So I think the whole idea that, you know, we have to worry about who's going to become the Speaker, and you know, maybe if I'm elected, that'll upset things. I think we have to get out of that logic and start to think about what would happen if I got elected. The signal that would send to the entire representative body down in Olympia, and consider what I would do in similarity to what Shema has done in the Seattle City Council. I recognize that there's, you know, technical differences between, you know, a body of nine on the Seattle City Council that's entirely, you know, Democratic and one socialist versus down in, you know, Olympia, where you actually have Republicans down there, you have right-wing Democrats down there, and there's a lot more people you have to work with. So I understand the technical difficulties, but the method that we would, you know, employ to really advance working class interests is the same. We would go out there and build a campaign for taxing millionaires, for ending corporate welfare, just as we did with launching 15 Now and going out there and building support for a $15 an hour minimum wage in the communities. We would go out there and campaign on lifting the ban on rent control. The whole point of this isn't just to get somebody elected. This isn't just about me. It's about registering the anger and the frustration at the status quo of politics as usual, not working for working people, and also to go out there and get regular people involved in the political process. That's missing right now. There isn't that pressure from working people on elected officials that they're feeling, that they, you know, that they feel like they really need to take up the issues that we care about most. Instead, the pressure on them is from their corporate donors and the business lobbyists that are swarming Olympia, telling them that, you know, we want this bill passed or we want you to not pass this bill. We need to really rally people behind issues so that we can get them passed, much like we did with the $15 an hour minimum wage. That would not have passed in its current form if we had not had people out there marching, rallying, you know, tabling every weekend and going out and talking with their neighbors. If that pressure from ordinary working people had not been on the Seattle City Council and had not been on the mayor's advisory task force, then we would not have had a strong $15 an hour minimum wage ordinance passed, even though it had those corporate loopholes, which of course we're not happy about. To us, that shows that we need to build an even more powerful movement, not that the movement that we did build wasn't what got it done. I think we need to take that lesson and what's possible down in Olympia too, and sort of reject this lesser evilism logic or this worry about, you know, how it'll shift the Democratic caucus and who might come in. I think we need to think a little bit bigger and understand it's not just swapping out Frank Chop's vote for mine. It would change the whole political conversation.
So specifically, how would you get us to 100%, or how would you propose to get us to 100% renewables, and what would be the timeline on that?
We have a whole swath of land in eastern Washington that I know that different departments have looked at to sort of see how much wind power could be generated. And it's a lot. There's a lot of land out there. We could be putting solar panels on all the buildings in Seattle and in, you know, buildings all across Washington state. The technology exists. What's lacking is an investment in it to go out there and really expand the production of solar and wind turbines and then install them everywhere. We also need a new electric grid to deal with the different types of energy that would be produced. All of that would massively create jobs. There are workers right now that are trained and ready to go to work on these projects, but there's nobody advocating for actually expanding the investment here and also expanding it in a way that's progressive, that it's reliably funded and not asking working people to pay more in gas taxes or, you know, pitting road projects against transit projects. I think really what's required is somebody saying that what we're doing is not enough. We're not doing enough to deal with global warming. And the problem that we're dealing with unemployment, there's still unemployment and underemployment, even though we're in a so-called recovery. And the fact that we're facing global warming, you know, with the new climate assessment coming out this year, the IPCC report coming out this year, and really laying it out bare that climate change isn't the future, it's right now. We're dealing with it right now. We need to take it seriously and plan for the future. Both of those things can be met by massively investing in clean, renewable energy, shifting away from fossil fuels, and making sure we have the energy that's necessary so that we can have our high living standards, but we power that in a clean, renewable way. Really, what's required is ending the corporate welfare so that we can fund these projects, so that we don't have to take funding from education. We don't have to take funding from, you know, human and health services. We can create the funding pool necessary to invest in clean, renewable energy. I'm not trying to, you know, make it seem like it's super simple, but to me, it's just obvious. You create the revenue that's necessary, you say what it's necessary for, and you go out there and you build on a campaign for it. There are a lot of people in this state that are environmentally conscious and want to see bold action on this, and they rightfully applaud the steps that are taken in the right direction by the new governor, by Obama coming out with the new EPA regulations. But these steps that are being taken are, to me, baby steps. I mean, I'm a climate scientist. What we're facing requires bold action. It requires giant leaps forward because the politicians have been dragging their feet for decades. We don't have time for another, you know, task force to decide a cap and trade mechanism that may or may not work. We need to tax the wealthy and the big corporations, fund transit, fund clean renewable energy, and really put us on a pathway to our sustainable future.
So sticking with the concept of wind, let's say wind farms, Eastern Washington, would this then be a public utility that the state would be paying, making the down payment on?
Absolutely, it should be a public utility. I don't think it should be privately owned or run in any way for profit. Much like Seattle City Light, which has its problems, we need to be making sure that this is a not-for-profit, that this is publicly owned, publicly run, and the energy costs can be lowered this way. You know, really, it's just the cost of the upkeep and the initial investment that's necessary. It's different, you know, from a coal-fired plant or from fossil fuels in general, where you have to constantly extract, ship, and burn fossil fuels, which lead to higher costs. People talk all the time about how coal and natural gas cost less than solar and wind, but the costs of solar and wind have gone down dramatically, and there's lots of new technology that we can be employing to drive those costs down as well. But really, the initial costs are really what's in front of us. After that, the cost of the upkeep isn't very much, and it creates a lot more jobs than the fossil fuel industry, and it can employ some of the same workers from one industry to another. So I think that, you know, that's one big reason why we need to move to clean renewables, so that we can provide much cheaper, if not free, energy to everybody that lives in Washington State and actually be a leader in the United States for what's possible to, you know, put people back to work and put us on a sustainable pathway so that other states can follow suit.
I read earlier this week that in the U.S. there are now more people employed in the solar power industry than there are in coal, mm-hmm. in the coal industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, coal has been slashing jobs for decades as they've gone to more disruptive ways to unearth the reserves. I mean, they've gone to mountaintop blasting, which is or mountaintop removal, which is incredibly disheartening, and also destructive to the families that live nearby. Yeah, I mean, reports show all the time that clean renewable energy infrastructure projects hire a lot more people. And these are also career jobs. These are jobs where people will be employed for their entire lives if they like, rather than, you know, a coal job where you're dealing with a private industry that's really going to exploit you as much as they can. And also it's an extremely dangerous job. Fossil fuel jobs are extremely dangerous. So that's another argument for why we should be moving to clean renewable.
And specifically with the taxing the large corporations and the extremely wealthy, do you have numbers proposed for that at this point? I mean, do you anticipate it'd be, for instance, with the wealthy, if you make over X amount, you would be taxed X amount?
No, I mean, I think I would look at what Shama was pushing for last year, which was a millionaire tax, right? If you make a million or more in income, then we would tax that. By how much? I don't know. We'd have to look at the numbers. It doesn't have to be a really large tax. But we would talk about, you know, making sure that it's known to people that this is a millionaire tax, that it's a tax on income above a certain amount. I think if you look at 1098, when they tried to pass that a few years ago, it was labeled as an income tax. And a lot of working people rightfully feared that it was a slippery slope. And if you start to introduce an income tax on $200,000, $250,000 a year, would that start to slide down to $50,000 a year? You know, And people dealing with the most regressive taxes in the country rightfully worried about that. They didn't trust the Democratic Party not to enact an income tax on top of their sales taxes, their entertainment taxes. So I think we need to look at that type of thing, but make sure that it's unambiguous, that it's really to tax those who have the most wealth and ease the burden of taxes on working people. You know, there's ways that we can close those corporate loopholes. You can tax more wealthy people and then lower the sales taxes, ease the tax burden on working people. The actual numbers, we'd have to look more in detail of what's necessary to create the revenue pools that we need to fund transit, to fund education, to fund social services. But again, there's so much wealth in Washington State. You wouldn't need really high taxes to provide this revenue. There's, you know, a small tax would provide enough.
You mentioned earlier, I think it was for King County, did you say 68,000 millionaires?
Yes.
And my understanding is it's like one of the most densely populated by millionaires counties in the country.
That's right. It is. And I think in the world, too, we have multimillionaires that are living here. I mean, we have no income tax. So they can live here without seeing their income tax in any way. We also don't have a capital gains tax. A lot of the ways that really wealthy people make money is they make money through capital gains, not necessarily through their salary. So that's why, you know, they pay a much lower tax rate than working people. And we need to change that. We need to make sure that, you know, those that have the most are paying their fair share. And we have, as you said, a lot of people that live in Seattle, a lot of people that live in King County and Washington State that have a lot of wealth. And if you talk to some of them, they're very happy to say, yes, the tax burden needs to be lifted off of working people and put on the people that can afford it. Otherwise, they're also affected by the cuts to transit. They're also affected by the underfunding of education. So, you know, we need to shift that burden onto those that can afford it the most.
All right. Just a couple minutes left. Can you touch on very quickly what you would propose for workers at the state level?
What I would propose for workers? I think what I would propose is that we all start to get politically involved and be engaged. And if we want higher wages, if we want to increase the minimum wage statewide, which is necessary, 932, it's the highest in the country, although a few states have passed up to 1010. And I think Massachusetts just passed to 11, which will happen incrementally. So we're being passed by other states. But even 932 an hour is not enough, not just in Seattle, but in other, you know, municipalities around the state. We need to increase the minimum wage. There's been talk about $12 an hour, but I would be bold and say we need 15. And we should be out there campaigning for it and do everything we can to force the other elected officials to side with workers against the corporate, you know, the corporations that fund their campaigns. And I think we need to recognize that what happened with the Fight for 15 in Seattle has lessons for all the other issues that working people care about, whether you need a raise for teachers or state employees, or just if you're working at a job that's non-unionized. The lesson is that there's power by uniting together with other people and going out there and demanding your rights. I mean, it may look odd to people that that's what wins the day, that going out there and marching in the street and carrying signs and chanting and all of that seems odd to people that haven't seen mass movements, and we haven't seen them in this country in generations, that that's actually what wins the day. But, you know, just a look at history will show you everybody's aware of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the LGBTQ movement, the environmental movement. Those things all have movement at the end of them for a reason. Because we know that it took, you know, thousands and millions of people coming together, demanding rights. That's how we won, you know, civil rights, women's rights, environmental protections. And if we want to, you know, have more rights on the job, higher wages and benefits, actual jobs that are careers and that are safe, then we need to go out there, unite together in our community, and demand those rights.
We're talking with Jess Speer. She is candidate for the Washington State Legislature, 43rd District, Position 2. How can people find out more about your campaign?
They can go to votespear.org, that's VOTESPEAR.org, to sign up to get involved, and also please make a contribution. We take no corporate funding. Our our campaign is entirely grassroots funded.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.